All right. So I gather you may have had a longer interest in the problem of drug abuse research than the buprenorphine story. So if you could, for me, start with your pathway into the field. How did it come to be a problem that interested you?
Back in some decade that I don't remember, I was doing contract packaging for running a small company that did contract packaging for hospital pharmacies, principally in Virginia, doing the Medical College of Virginia and the University of Virginia, at a time when unit dose packaging first came into being. And in the course of that business, there was a need at a methadone treatment program, which had initially been part of VCU, or MCV, for take-home doses of methadone to be developed. And we developed a 1 ounce individual bottle of vehicle called Methabuse, which was a vehicle for the dispensing of methadone. This was long before the computerized systems that we have today.
And what was your role in that?
Well, I was running that company, so I, in the process of that company, I began developing what we hoped would be an abuse-resistant vehicle for dispensing methadone so that patients could take the methadone home. It was actually a... we used psyllium husk to add after the... When they dispensed the methadone into the vehicle, they then dispensed a measured amount of psyllium and shook the bottle, which turned it into a gel. And they were given that bottle and a wooden stick to pull it out of when they went home, and they mixed that with water, diluted it with water, so that they could take their methadone home, and kids couldn't get into the vehicle.
So prior to that time, had you had any exposure to methadone maintenance or opiate addiction?
No, but at the same, along about that same time, for that program, we began to develop a toxicology laboratory. We opened a small toxicology laboratory to do urine analysis for drugs of abuse.
And is that where you came across Chuck Gorodetsky?
I don't remember the first time I came across Chuck Gorodetsky.
Okay. And would you have said that is in 1970s or...
Yeah,
late
it was
60s.
Earlier. It was probably late 60s.
You think it was late 60s?
Yeah, it was late 60s, I think.
Okay. And...
It was late 60s, because after that we started also doing... providing the same services to the drug treatment programs in Atlanta. And that was when President Jimmy Carter was governor of Georgia, so whatever that time frame was, may have been early, late 60s, early 70s.
Okay.
Well, it must have been when the...
It would have been
Nixon
the
went into office at 72.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what were you doing during that era?
So it was late 60s. It was around 68 or 70, something like that. Because when, in the Nixon administration, when Jerry Jaffe went into as drug czar, one of the people, among many of the people still around who was there, was Peter Bourne. And Peter Bourne brought me in to do a lot of work in the field of toxicology, laboratory testing.
So you are the Charles O'Keefe who was associated with Peter Bourne?
Yes.
Okay. Good. So he brought you in, you mean to D.C.?
Well, I was in D.C. at that time. Actually, I had sold the laboratory, toxicology laboratory, and merged it with Washington Reference Laboratory. Washington Reference Laboratory had the contract for military urine analysis during Vietnam. And I subsequently became executive vice president of that laboratory, of Washington Reference Laboratory. And we developed, did a lot of urine analysis for them. We had the DOD contract for urine analysis at that time. And then I also was doing, working with, digs back into the past. I also did some work on the Carter campaign at that time, and I was working with Peter in something called Foundation for International Resources during the campaign, whenever that was.
And was it specifically around drug issues at all?
Yeah, it was primarily around drug issues. I did a lot of consulting with WHO, for example. I did various missions to places like Afghanistan and Pakistan to look at opiate dependence in Afghanistan back in those early years as well.
And to look at how? What kinds of approaches were you using?
The question in Afghanistan at that time was what's the extent of addiction in Afghanistan? Specifically, it was up in the northeastern part of Afghanistan, along the border with Pakistan, where there was a fair amount of the Badakhshan province, which goes way up and runs over the Hindu Kush into China, and did a couple of missions up there for them, and then did one in Pakistan on the Vend system of dispensing narcotics to addicts in Pakistan.
And so these were maintenance?
Well, they were actually, my role was to go over and look at the extent of addiction in those areas, so that WHO could then sort of next step, what do you do about it now that you've seen it? There are issues of production, and there are issues of addiction, and what's the extent of the addiction? To what extent does the addiction drive the production?
To what extent did it?
Nobody knows. It probably drove it. The addiction was fairly widespread, and I would guess that the incidence of addiction was greater in the Badakhshan province of Afghanistan than it was in the streets of Washington, on a per capita basis. Mm-hmm. So it was extensive. Generally smoked opium. But it was an extensive problem. Huge amounts of poverty, and there's nothing up there. It's a tough area.
And at the time, what kinds of policies or responses were people putting into place?
Well, the WHO asked me to go because, I don't know why they asked me to go, but I was available, so...
You were available and you had a certain skill set.
I guess. I don't know what the reason was, but it was an interesting place to go when you're young and foolish and willing to go ride on camels and yaks to get to the Badakhshan province of Afghanistan.
What was the extent of your training? I mean, how...
Well, in those days, there were not many people who had much training in addiction treatment. And so my training had nothing to do with addiction. I was much more inclined to run laboratories and do that sort of thing. and package pills. And
so what did you make of this endemic situation?
Well, I just found it fascinating, and I found it an area that was in desperate need of somebody should do something. I'm not quite sure that I knew who should do anything, but clearly in the U.S., methadone seemed to offer some real promise, and substitution therapy at that point was, it worked despite the fact that a lot of folks didn't like it, and the whole controversy around that. But
yes.
But it did seem to work, and so I sort of moved in, those areas, and then I went subsequently into the White House in the Carter years, and I was Peter Bourne's deputy in his White House office on international health, and I was appointed a member of the Strategy Council and by the President, and sort of did the White House policy thing.
And how long were you there?
I was there during the Carter administration.
So
during the most of the Carter administration. Mm-hmm. From the very beginning, I left at sort of the end. I moved over later on to do some the Cuban Haitian task force when that when the Mariel boat lift became a problem. Mm-hmm. I went over and did some of that.
And did you leave when Peter left?
I left shortly after Peter left. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So
because
so
Peter was deputy, Peter had two roles. One was special assistant to the president for international health, and the other role was the director of the Office of Drug Abuse Policy.
Yes.
I too had two roles. I was Peter's deputy in the White House, and I was deputy director for international affairs at the Office of Drug Abuse Policy.
Okay. So it's for someone who was good at running laboratories and packaging pills, this kind of jump into not just, domestic policy and international health policy must have seemed, how did you do it? What did you have to learn in order to do it?
I don't know. How does one learn anything? One just sort of jumps in. I mean, I had done the WHO stuff. I had been invited to various places to go to conferences, and somebody said, well, he goes to a lot of places, he must know something, so and you just sort of do it.
My understanding of Peter Bourne's situation was that drug policy was a driving factor for him, that the international health was less compelling in some ways.
I think
did you share his interests?
Yeah, I did. I mean, we did international health policy, and that was an issue. But drug abuse policy was the driving force behind Peter.
And what were you hoping to accomplish?
Well, I think it was a time of trying to bring together the treatment people and the enforcement people to somehow see if we could solve a problem that seemed to be enormous. And Peter did a lot of very good work of coordinating agencies that had been difficult to do before. And he brought in, I think, Bob DuPont was running NIDA at the time, and Peter Bensinger was doing DEA, Mathia Falco was at State, and there was a real concerted effort from a policy point of view to bring those people together and not have them fighting and arguing and to sort of bring treatment into the forefront. And to have the DEA understand the treatment, and I think they did. I think they went a long way under Peter to sort of focus on the issue of there's a real there's a real problem with addiction. And so what we hoped to accomplish was to develop a coordinated policy that would ultimately address a problem.
I'm going to come back to how you feel in terms of the relative success or failure of that. But was there, prior to the Carter administration, had there been a thawing in international policy towards treatment? Had there been an attempt to use treatment as a kind of policy tool?
There was an office of, there was an international office at NIDA. That
and who?
J. Paul Smith was in, I think. I don't remember. Or I sort of vaguely remember Jean Paul Smith being at NIDA at some place. There clearly was interest in treatment, and I don't know that anybody was focusing internationally on treatment beyond that. Peter might be able to tell you. Have you talked to Peter?
I have met him a long time ago. Yeah. And haven't, you know, followed him up with this project, but I think we should.
Oh, yeah, sure. He's an integral part of of the policy, of certainly for a good 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So there was some preparation for you coming in, but for the most part it was you guys
sort of
who
fell in,
created this. Yeah. And so how do you feel about the, how far did you get?
Well, in retrospect, I don't, you know, we probably didn't get much further than any other administration.
Mm-hmm.
I think you are, while you're there, you're working 12 to 14 hours a day to move forward on your the concepts of what you want to happen, and you're trying to work the WHO and work the Commission on Narcotic Drugs and probably more attention being paid to those bodies from the White House than there is now, I think. And that would be my sort of view. The international thing, I think one of the successes was that we established the assistant secretary level position at state for narcotics matters, which had not been done before. It was prior to that. It was who was it that was in that job? There was an assistant to the secretary for international narcotics matters. I think is what it was before, and that was created in that. I think we created that. I'm almost sure we did. And the person that went in there was Mathea Falco, and Mathea came out of Tom Bryant's operation, the Drug Abuse Foundation, which was more treatment-oriented than anything. And consequently, Mathea had a view toward treatment that was more pro-treatment than maybe previous people at state had. And she became an integral part of the sort of interagency thing. Probably state has moved away from treatment pretty much now, and they're doing all their off-the-record guns and helicopters and stuff like that. Typical diplomacy at the time.
So back to the interagency coordination aspect of it. What was it like working with NIDA at that time? Did your priorities and NIDA's priorities align pretty well?
Yeah, I think so. Bob DuPont was running it, and he had a view of treatment, and I mean, he was quite a competent guy, and certainly brought in that coordination worked very well. I think that he had a lot of respect for Mathea and for Bob, and they had respect for him, so I think it worked reasonably well. I didn't see. I mean, you didn't have the. I don't think the tensions were as high as you get sometimes between enforcement and mm-hmm. in subsequent years. Mm-hmm. But I think they were, you know, Bob was a bright guy. He knew what he wanted to do, and he was a strong leader, so mm-hmm. he did a good job.
So NIDA has obviously, in some ways, evolved into something else. I mean, evolved into an NIH institute.
Well, it is an NIH institute now, and prior to that, they did a lot of, I mean, I don't know whether somebody else can give you the history of NIDA and how that developed. I'm not quite sure how it all happened, but yeah, it's a little different now. It's very different now.
Mm-hmm. So, can you characterize a little bit the differences? What it was like then?
Well, I mean, Bob DuPont would be a much better person to talk to than I am.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's been very helpful.
And we'll have probably a better memory of it than I will. But I just viewed NIDA as, you know, they were the treatment folks. Mm-hmm. Pure and simple, mm-hmm. they were the treatment folks.
Not the science guys.
Yeah, but there weren't many science guys.
You know? Right.
I mean, there were. There was CPDD, the College on Problems of Drug Dependence, which was not a member organization.
And when did you start going to CPDD? Did you go in those years?
Yes, probably in those years I was going to CPDD.
So you would have begun when?
I went going when, CPDD was...
Can you remember your first meeting?
Well, that's what I'm trying to think, whether it was... I mean, there was a meeting in Richmond long ago, and a meeting in Baltimore long ago. Was it Baltimore? Yeah, there was one in Baltimore.
At the Lord Baltimore Hotel?
At the Lord Baltimore Hotel, where I left a pair of shoes, as a matter of fact. Lost forever.
Okay.
There was one at the Marriott in Richmond. I don't know what years these were. Where were some of the other early ones?
Well,
in those days.
Depends what you mean by early.
They still do the one at ACNP. I remember doing one at ACNP, visiting with, well, actually it was the board met with ACNP in Honolulu back at the time. Oh God, I must have been doing it when I was with Sterling.
When were you with Sterling?
I was with Sterling after the White House, I guess.
Is that where you went to from your White House job?
Yeah, I went. Yep, I went to Sterling after the White House. I was VP Government Affairs for Sterling. So I was doing, and Sterling had an issue with T's and blues, the pentazocine issue. And the WHO was looking at pentazocine, scheduling of pentazocine. So I was doing CPDD. I was doing CPDD meetings at around that time. That was 80. Something. That may have been later, though. That was later 80s, wasn't it? The T's and blues stuff.
Well, yes.
Maybe it was. Maybe it was early. Eh?
I will date that I can do. That I can do.
It's T's and blues, whatever that.
Yes.
Whatever that thing was.
Quite a bit on that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was the job that you went to after the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And did you leave because of the scandal surrounding Peter?
No, but Peter's... Well, it was... Peter was leaving, and I was his deputy, and I was doing... While I had an assignment at ODAP, I don't think it was called ODAP at that time, Office of Drug Abuse Policy, my principal, all of my time was spent doing, not all of it, but a lot of my time was spent doing other things, and tobacco stuff, fighting Joe Califano over tobacco resolutions at the World Health Organization and things like that. And I left there was an opportunity to leave and do the Cuban-Haitian, which was a real problem, and it was sort of a sexy thing to do right then. Mm-hmm. So I went over and did that. I did that in, must have been 79 or late 79 or 80 or something like that. Right at the end of the, it would have been shortly after Peter left, mm-hmm. that I went to do that.
And from there,
I went on
you
to
went
Sterling.
Back to Sterling. And what attracted you to Sterling in particular?
Well, Sterling was concerned about scheduling. I think of Pentasisi. That's probably what I did. And I was VP Government Affairs at Sterling, and the president of Sterling. Chairman of Sterling at that time was president of the IFPMA in Geneva, the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Associations. And he wanted IFPMA to be involved in the activities of the WHO around scheduling drug substances. And so he created a committee on psychotropic substances committee or something like that.
And had you been dealing with scheduling issues before that?
Well, we had been looking at scheduling issues just in the interagency stuff, mm-hmm. Monitoring, scheduling in various. It was not, we looked at various things. I recall in the White House, there was probably discussion of Don Jasinski's work on buprenorphine, along with John Lewis. There was a whole class of compounds, the Bentley compounds, so-called Bentley compounds, that were produced by Reckitt and Coleman at that time. One of them was atorphine, the other was buprenorphine, and there were some others in there.
What were they called, the Bentley compounds?
Fellow who ran the R&D department at Reckitt and Coleman named Bentley.
Okay, but John Lewis
was the chemist who sort of the father of
yes.
buprenorphine. And
yes. Okay. And so they had them at Lexington, or they?
Well, they did. John Lewis had been involved for a long time, and with Don Jasinski, and they had. Certainly buprenorphine. I don't know whether they did any atorphine. Although they may have done some atorphine.
I think
as well.
So. Yeah. When do you think John Lewis? So he synthesized buprenorphine.
He did. Yep. That whole family of compounds.
Okay, so that whole family. They had at Lexington for testing, essentially.
I'm sure they had most of them at Lexington. I don't know which ones they had, but Don Jasinski can tell mm-hmm. you which ones they had. Yeah.
Okay, and. So when did you become aware of this family compounds?
Well, I became aware of it when I was in the White House because they were new and they were incredibly potent, and obviously when the news media picks up something that's 300 times or 500 times or 1,000 times more potent than morphine, you read it and say, uh-oh, maybe we better find out what this is all about. This would be good stuff to get on the street. And we looked into it and ultimately just said, well, it's research compounds and it's being done at places like Lexington.
So did you literally learn about buprenorphine from reading about it? There was no other way that you would know. That
it was read about, and where I read about it, it may have been Jasinski's publication. First
the
publication was 78,
yeah.
So it's probably, that's probably the.
And what did you do when you realized that there were these potent compounds down there?
Nothing. We talked about it.
Was it a galvanizing event? What?
No. It wasn't.
So at that point, did you have any idea? Don seemed to have some idea that it might be useful for
Don
training.
Had the idea that it would be useful. John Lewis and Don Jasinski are the people who...
And what about Ed Johnson? Would you include him in that?
Yeah, well, Ed was working for Don at that point, mm-hmm. down there. But clearly it was Don who was the person who... Well, you know Don as well as I do. I'm sure you've talked to him.
I have a four-hour interview with Don.
I'm sure you do.
But John, you think, also thought that there was...
Well, yeah, I think Don and John were fairly close, and they, you know, it sort of clicked right off the bat, I think.
Right.
And John started supplying NIDA with buprenorphine over the years.
With the knowledge of the company, right?
Yeah, with the knowledge of the company. Certainly it was with the knowledge of the company. The company's view of buprenorphine at that time, I'm told, and I wasn't there, but certainly was, well, it's an interesting compound, but people get caught up in this buprenorphine whirlwind, and they can't think about anything else except buprenorphine.
And, so did that, in fact, happen early on?
What, the buprenorphine whirlwind?
Yeah, that you call it that?
Yeah, it was a buprenorphine whirlwind. And that was coined probably by the directors of the company who looked at John Lewis and saw this whirlwind of activity surrounding buprenorphine and John's determination that this drug had a lot of potential.
So John really was the champion of it?
Oh, he clearly was the champion, yeah. Had he not continued to provide NIDA with buprenorphine through the years, it certainly would not have. And he was here, you know, he was here at CPDD and he was publishing and he was just doing huge amounts of things with buprenorphine. Telling everybody how great it was and how wonderful it was.
And what do you think really did that for him? Why?
Well, because he is he's an obsessive chemist who
seems to take that.
That's right. And you know, he's just determined to find out everything that you can find out about this. And, you know, he talked to everybody about it, and he would just sort of do his thing.
So when did you get caught up in the whirlwind?
When I left Sterling. Sterling was sold by, Sterling... was owned by Kodak. There was a hostile takeover attempt by Hoffman LaRoche, and Kodak came in as a white knight and said, "Let's merge the two companies." And I was there at that time, and we had an opportunity to leave at that time with some pretty generous packages. So I left and started doing consulting.
And was that was sometime in the 80s? When was that?
It was probably... I'd have to look and see. It was 80-something, I don't know.
Early 80s.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. All right.
And I went off and did consulting for various and sundry people in the pharmaceutical industry, one of which was a small company in Richmond, the Ethyl Corporation. Ethyl bought a small pharmaceutical company that was selling don't know what they were selling. They were selling some oxycodone or hydrocodone or, you know, some generic stuff. One of the Ethyl Corporation is, I don't know if you know anything about Ethyl, but it's a company that does gasoline additives.
Ethyl?
Ethyl.
I know about them from their EPA, EPA lawsuit.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
right. Just the getting lead out.
Well,
right.
That's right. And, but they had a number of divisions that were. Ethyl has an interesting history all by itself. It was a tiny little Richmond company that bought this gigantic Ethyl company because they were going to go bankrupt and they were going to do all sorts of things. So a tiny little Richmond company owned by the family, Richmond family, the Gottwalds. And so they bought it and made it into what it is today. Well, the Gottwald children, there were several sons, and off the record, Daddy bought companies for each of his sons. He had one son who was a physician, and he decided that made him qualified to be on a pharmaceutical company. So he bought a pharmaceutical company. And Ethyl, by the way, was a very large producer of ibuprofen, drug substance. And although they never sold any of it, I mean, it was always sold to somebody else, and they never marketed it. But the Whitby Pharmaceuticals was the name of the company. And Whitby Pharmaceuticals had a desire to grow and become a major pharmaceutical player, and they wanted to find a product that they could buy that would merge with their generic oxycodone or hydrocodone or whatever it was at the time. And they looked at buprenorphine as a potential analgesic that was available or could be available. And the reason for that is that at that time, buprenorphine was licensed to Norwich Eaton.
Right.
And Norwich Eaton and Reckitt and Coleman were likely to have parted ways on the licensing agreement because Norwich Eaton was not performing up to Reckitt's expectation with this injectable product, and they had not developed the sublingual tablet formulation.
I see. Now, at that point, what was the role of Don and those guys? I mean, did Don ever want in?
No, I don't think so. Don was doing his thing. Don was doing his research.
So he had sort of not stayed that interested in buprenorphine.
Well, I mean, I think he had, because there were, when they moved to Baltimore, you know, they were still doing work, he was doing a fair amount of stuff, mm-hmm. And Don, Ed Johnson worked for Don at that point, and so they were, and Paul Fadella and Jerry Jaffe, they did that.
Yes, they did
that study.
They were
doing that study. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'd say that Don was involved and very close to John, and trying to move it forward. I mean, I think he was very much wanting to move it forward. But Norwich Eaton and Reckitt and Coleman were coming to a juncture in their relationship that was going to lead to the license going back to Reckitt and Coleman. Mm-hmm. And Reckitt and Coleman was thinking in terms of finding another licensee or of selling buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. And buprenorphine was, in the U.S., a relatively small product and simply an injectable analgesic, despite the fact that by that time there was a fair amount of work going on, and NIDA was continuing to sort of move forward with work, and a lot of people, not a lot of NIDA grantees, were doing some really good work on buprenorphine.
And who within NIDA was there somebody pushing?
Well, I can recall Lou Harris when Bob Schuster set up the Medications Development Division at NIDA, and Charlie Grudzinskas was put in there as Medications Development, and Bob Schuster was pushing for buprenorphine to be developed for treatment as a part of and setting up the Medication Development Division. And Lou Harris went up and spent some time as a special assistant or something to Bob. And Lou went to Ricketts and said, "Come on, guys, let's make this happen. Let's keep on making it happen." And Reckitt and Coleman actually could not do it because they still had the drug was still licensed to Norgeton, and Norgeton had said, "We have absolutely no interest in developing this drug for the treatment of opiate dependence."
So why didn't they just let them do it if they wanted to do it? They had to let the license expire or something?
Well, yeah, the license, if who wanted to do it? If NIDA wanted to do it? Well, all the rights to buprenorphine that Reckitt and Coleman had were licensed to Norgeton. Mm-hmm. So Reckitt and Coleman's hands were tied. They could not develop it when Norgeton said, "We don't want to develop it."
And about when do you think that Norwich Eaton's license expired?
That was the time that I went with Ricketts, and I don't know when that was.
So you went to Reckitt when it was Reckitt Coleman?
It was Reckitt and Coleman, yeah, that's right. And Reckitt and Coleman, I was initially a consultant to Reckitt and Coleman on issues around scheduling, because there was the whole scheduling stuff. And John Lewis and I were working back earlier. John Lewis was defending buprenorphine at the World Health Organization, and I was defending pentazocine at the World Health Organization. And John and I were on that same committee that was established by what's his name? The former CEO, former chairman of Sterling. Anyhow. He was president of the University of Minnesota, something, before becoming chairman of Sterling. Anyhow, so John was defending buprenorphine, and I was defending pentazocine, and what's his name, Bristol Myers at Bristol was defending whatever the other partial agonist, antagonist. So then when that license was about to expire, and I was doing consulting for Reckitt and Coleman, I was also doing some consulting for Whitby. Whitby attempted to buy buprenorphine from Reckitt and Coleman, and they had to deal with a fairly obstinate British lawyer named Peter Milligan, and they couldn't get along with Peter Milligan, so ultimately they were not able to buy it.
When you're talking about scheduling, you use the term defending, like each of you is sort of defending your drug, and that means...
Well, it was a joint effort of defending the class of drugs to keep the agonist-antagonist. It was pentazocine, buprenorphine, butorphanol, nalbuphine, all of those compounds that were sort of different from morphine. Mm-hmm. There was an effort to move them to put them on some schedule, some treaty, and the effort was to get them placed on the psychotropics convention instead of the single convention. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the first effort was to get them, and, well, that was the major effort to either there was no concern about having them scheduled, but there was a concern about the level of scheduling.
Yes.
And the treaty under which they would be controlled.
And the advantage of having them on the Psychotropics Convention as opposed to the single convention is?
If a drug is placed on the single convention, there is a sentiment at the DEA that drugs on the single convention go into Schedule 2 of the Controlled Substances Act. Technically, that could not happen, but the DEA mentality is if it's in the single convention, it's in Schedule 2. There are exceptions, but that's the sort of, that's the reason for it.
Good.
So, in that respect, Whitby was not able to buy buprenorphine. Reckitt and Coleman and Norwich Eaton were coming down to a very tight deadline about how do you... I think Norwich Eaton would like to have kept buprenorphine, but they would like for the terms of the agreement to be modified so that they were not paying as much royalty to Reckitt and Coleman because the sales were not what they were. Reckitt and Coleman's view was, you either keep paying us that amount of money or we're going to license it to somebody else because we think the drug is going to, it should be developed, the sublingual tablet formulation of the product for analgesia should be developed. And Norwich Eaton believed that Reckitt and Coleman would not, off the record I think, Norwich Eaton probably believed that if they waited until the last minute to tell Reckitt and Coleman that they were going to terminate the agreement, that Reckitt and Coleman was going to be in such a short period of time, and I think it was 60 or 90 days that they had to turn the license. They had to turn the license in 60 or 90 days before the termination of the agreement. So if they waited until the last minute, Reckitt and Coleman would not be able to find a new licensee in the 60 days or whatever it was. I think it was 60. In the 60 days, so it would go off the market, and therefore Reckitt and Coleman would come back to them and say, okay, you can have it for less. Reckitt and Coleman, they didn't believe that, they didn't count on this obstinate lawyer named Peter Milligan in England who said nasty things about them. And said, I'll be damned if you're going to have it for less. So Peter Milligan then called me and said, can we set up a pharmaceutical company to keep Buprenex, was the product, distributed in the U.S. within 60 days, within the next 60 days? And I said, I don't know, but we'll try. So that was the reason Reckitt and Coleman Pharmaceuticals U.S. was set up very, very quickly as essentially a virtual, it wasn't a virtual company because we just sort of did it. I mean, they, Reckitt and Coleman had offices and, you know, all sorts of support in the larger company, but in fact we just set up Reckitt and Coleman Pharmaceuticals as an office in Richmond, Virginia, as my office in Richmond, Virginia.
So did you really believe in this drug?
Well, you know, I was consulting, and I was, can you do a job? And yeah, we can do that. So we did it. And shortly after we took it over, NIDA, in its wisdom, said, okay, Reckitt and Coleman doesn't have any choice now but to succumb to our pressure because now they don't have the excuse of Norwich Eaton behind them. And Charles O'Keefe is in there, and he knows something about addiction. And therefore, if you've got John Lewis, who's an absolute believer, and Charles O'Keefe, who's going to do it, we ought to be able to convince Reckitt and Coleman now to
And who is it in NIDA at that point? Who's who sees this?
Well, it was Bob, and it was and I guess by that time it was the whole system, and it was I guess Frank was there by then.
By then
too.
He was.
Yeah, by then it was Frank. Well, Frank was probably it, and you know, and it was all the people at NIDA that had, you know, that had all sorts of grants out on buprenorphine, and John had continued to feed the buprenorphine in despite Ricketts saying, "Hey, we're not going to do it."
For studies.
Yeah. And John had just kept on.
So it's interesting. I mean, it's sort of as if the NIDA process and the sort of scientific study and the public, you know, treatment, sort of pressure for treatment, is sort of delinked in a way. But always, I mean.
But always, you had John Lewis over there pushing all these guys here and publishing all sorts of new papers and saying, yeah, why don't you do this? And then these guys would go to NIDA and say, yeah, why don't we do this? And NIDA would come to John and say, well, we need some drug, John. And John would dump the drug.
So John Lewis was just convinced that it would work as a treatment.
Oh, yeah, he was convinced. He was absolutely convinced. He knew it.
But he's a chemist, not a clinician.
That's right.
So
Don Jasinski had convinced him.
I see.
And then everybody that was doing the work, it was pretty clear that this drug actually was going to work. I mean, this is over a period of years that everybody was doing work because John kept on feeding the drug. And then you had people like Bob Schuster and Frank Bocci and, you know, that lots of folks were doing good work. And so it was a...
How did it then happen?
Well, it then happened that NIDA came to us and said, "Come on, guys, you gotta let's work together and make this happen." And John, at that time, off the record, was falling out of favor with the folks in Reckitt and Colton, unfortunately.
Because
of this buprenorphine whirlwind. And he was spending money like crazy. I mean, you know, he did a lot of stuff that they didn't know what he was doing. Bear in mind that Reckitt and Colman is a household products company, and buprenorphine is an aberration for them. Mm-hmm. It's very much out of sight, out of the way. And John was sort of falling out of favor. But he was also committed to make it happen. And shortly, at about the time that I went in, John was sort of retiring. He moved. He finally did a deal with them. They gave him some money and said, "Go away. We'll fund a department for you at Bristol, University of Bristol." And so they basically shunted. John did a deal with them. Well, if you give enough money to University of Bristol, I'll go to Bristol and I'll be a professor in Bristol, and I'll take some of these compounds I'm working with and I'll work on them down there, and you fund it for some period of time. And that's what happened. So John was moved out of the picture.
So Reckitt Colman just didn't see a market?
There was no market.
Yeah.
There was just no... The reason no pharmaceutical company or major company will get in, because there's no money in it. I mean, it really is not a... It's not a major, it's not a big blockbuster drug that you're going to get bajillions of dollars. It's not a billion-dollar drug. So NIDA kept coming to us, and at that point, John had tried to convince them, and I was fortunately able to go to the board of Reckitt and say, "Guys, you've got the drug back now. You don't have any excuse." And it's sort of the right thing to do. It's a small product. If you'll find somebody to take this product on to market it, that's fine. But the reality is that we can market the analgesic product. You can milk it, and you can get some money out of it every year, and that's fine. But the only future for this drug is going to be in addictions treatment. And you're not in that business, so you're not in the analgesic business. You're not going to develop it. You're not going to make a bajillion dollars out of it. So why don't you just work with NIDA and sort of make it happen. And they said, no, you can't do that. It's not. We make mustard, you know, and shoe polish. But ultimately, just by leaning on their, it's the right thing to do. And they were, in fact, they were English gentlemen who believed in that they did have some social responsibility. And along those lines, if you talk to them long enough, they said, okay, go ahead and do it. But don't spend any money.
So it's the right thing to do in terms of...
In terms of the drug obviously works. NIDA wants to develop it. NIDA is doing a good job without reckoning Coleman, except we're providing drug substance. But there are some problems. There were issues around it. They're developing a different dosage form than reckoning Coleman had. You need to develop a dosage form. You need to look at the whole schmear. But in reality, this drug is not your future. And if you develop it, you've already dumped lots of drug in there. You've spent a lot of money. And NIDA wants to do it, and you have some resource here that you're able to provide. You've got toxicologists and pharmacologists and chemists and, you know, all sorts of good people, many of whom are involved in this buprenorphine whirlwind, like Chris Chaplio, for example, who's one of the people. And Chris was working for John. He was a chemist in the lab with John, and he was in the R&D department, and he believed in it and that it worked. He had seen the studies. A fellow named Don Walter, who was just a young guy working for John Lewis, but he had done a lot of regulatory affairs stuff. He was a pharmacologist or a chemist, but he had looked at it and he had worked with NIDA, and you know, so these guys were interested. Yeah, let's work with NIDA to develop this. It really makes sense. And you know, so you've got this expertise at Reckitt's. NIDA was going down some paths of developing a dosage form, which was a liquid dosage form that had some issues with it, and clearly we could be helpful in that respect. And you know, why don't we do it? It's, you know, you're going to help people. It's the right thing to do. So ultimately, we did. I mean, that's how it. It was just sort of going back to the board saying, "Come on, guys, it's the right thing to do."
So your role in that process, you sort of became an advocate for that.
Yeah, I became an advocate for working with NIDA for developing the drug. Mm-hmm. And they finally said, "Go do it. Just don't spend any money." And fortunately, we were isolated enough in Richmond, away from the household business and away from England, and you know, just doing Buprenex, that nobody cared. You know, okay, go for it. Just keep sending us money, and we'll be okay.
So, in retrospect, how could the process have been expedited?
Oh yeah, it could have been expedited if Norwich Eaton had been willing to work with NIDA 5 years earlier, even more than that.
Can you think of ways for the government to become more capable of doing these kind of, I mean, this kind of public-private partnership stuff is tough. Is there a way to make it?
And there's a way to make it work with Reckitt and Coleman did it because it was there was no big deal. You know, they spent money that they didn't know they were spending, but they did it because it was the right thing to do, rather than because they were going to make a lot of money on it. They clearly saw that they were not going to make a lot of money on it, but it still was what should be done. There was good science there that said it was needed. You had NIDA saying they wanted to do it, and you know, it would be pretty irresponsible to not do it, because it's not your business, and it just happens. Major other pharmaceutical companies need to be enticed into doing it with money. And yeah, I think it could be done. Joe Biden had the idea of giving some exclusivity to some other drug that because exclusivity for a drug like that to treat addiction is no big deal. You know, you got to have it in order to hopefully get your money back. But nobody is going to. There's no promise of sizable profit from it. So despite the fact it needs to be done, if you can't make any money on it, then the best scientists are in the pharmaceutical industry are not going to devote their time working on it. So that's one of the options that might be possible. If you could transfer, if the drug were approved, if a really innovative drug for the treatment of addiction, whether it's cocaine or methamphetamine or opiates or whatever it is, was approved. And if a company knew that if they had this drug approved for this indication and they weren't going to make any money on it, despite the fact that they weren't going to make any money on it, they could transfer a year or two of that exclusivity into one of their major drugs, then suddenly that would be an incentive for them to work on it. Mm-hmm. Is that going to happen? I doubt it. I mean, I think it's a very good idea, but that would be hard to sell. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, giving a big drug company more exclusivity to make more money is, you know, it's hard to.
Right.
It's
right.
Hard to.
So how far into the process did you remain working for?
Well, I stayed until it was approved and it was time for them to start selling the drug. You know, that's not my thing, so.
So you retired upon that success?
I retired, yeah. After it was approved, we had it approved, and we actually had negotiated an agreement, because as it became pretty clear that the drug was going to be approved, during the process, it obviously was approved in France, because France decided, hey, last year we didn't have a drug problem, but we have a drug problem now. And so they looked and said, well, we should have methadone and we should have buprenorphine. And despite the fact that we weren't ready to submit the application in the U.S., France said, we want to approve buprenorphine. By this time,
so
you know,
they came to you?
Off the record. The French government came to Reckitt and Coleman and said, we want this application to be submitted. And this application will be approved. We're going to treat people for heroin addiction with methadone and buprenorphine.
Interesting.
And Reckitt and Coleman was not in a position to market the drug worldwide. And so they went out and said, let's find a partner. This has to be partnered. And they found a partner in Shearing Plough, and Shearing Plough agreed that they wanted to market the product, mm-hmm. because they had a presence in France and they knew that France wanted to.
So France, the approval was before?
Oh yeah, France, the approval was 10 years ago.
Yeah, and what about Britain?
That came later on.
More like the U.S. or?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit later. Mm-hmm. All the European ones sort of followed France, but France was the real mover in deciding we are going to treat with buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. And so we went in there into France. We first did the licensing agreement with Shearing Plough. Shearing Plough was reluctant to take on the U.S. They were saying, well, we'll take it everywhere, but maybe not the U.S. We actually forced them to include the U.S. in that agreement, off the record, by the way.
Okay.
And so that the product was then approved in France, and Shearing Plough had it. Then as it came closer to approval time in the U.S., it was pretty apparent to me, and this is totally off the record,
okay.
We were uncomfortable with the plans that Shearing Plough was making for marketing in the U.S. They appeared ready to market it as they would Claritin or any other drug, just sort of go out there.
Like direct to consumer.
Well, they would have done the full, absolutely full blast promotion. And that was of some concern to me concern to us. And so we ultimately suggested to Shearing Plough that maybe we'd like to buy it back from them in the U.S. Because, and fortunately, at the time, Shearing Plough was having a lot of problems with this is at the time when they had big problems with the FDA, and we were not happy with their relationship with the FDA. Mm-hmm. It was a difficult time for them. So we went back and paid them a fair amount of money. Well, we paid them.
Reckitt
and Coleman went and paid to get our own drug back in the United States. I think we paid them $80 million or $85 million or something to get it back. To get back our own drug.
It's such a
that we had begged them to take.
Such a story. It's amazing.
And then we spent all that money, and I said, "Hey guys, I'm out of here."
So then you shepherded it through the
FDA? We got it through the FDA, and the FDA approved the product, and we had gotten it back. We formalized the agreement with Shearing Plough just prior to approval.
And was the FDA approval relatively uneventful?
Yeah, I mean, it was a normal sort of battling back and forth and screaming and yelling and, you know, all those things that you do with the FDA and arguing over risk management plans and that sort of thing. But it was relatively uneventful. I mean, you know, there were off the record totally incompetent people there at during parts of the time. And Suboxone was actually an expedited approval or a priority drug, which meant that they were supposed to have, and the director of the division at one point said to us, "Well, we don't have to be in any hurry. This is not a priority drug." So we had our battles with them, but you know.
So as you now look at the risk management plan that's been put into place and the post-marketing surveillance and all of that, is that what you would have hoped for the drug?
Yeah, I think as I look at it in retrospect, now I've been away from it a year and a half or 2 years, and I've really tried to sort of watch it and keep the other reason I retired is my wife is sick.
Oh,
and
I'm sorry to hear
it,
that.
She's got ovarian cancer.
It's
a terrible thing. And it's just time to, you know, reprioritize your life. So that was the other reason. Plus, it needed to be done with the marketing people. I mean, people who know how to market drugs should do it. As I look at it, I mean, I think it's doing... it's doing almost exactly what we had projected to the new Reckitt Benckiser board when we went to them and said, "Yeah, this you should spend $80 million to take it back, and you'll get that back, and you'll get some of your development costs back. You won't make a pile of money, but it's a good investment." And so it's done, you know, almost exactly what we looked at. When you hear the DEA. Presentations here saying, you know, there's no big deal. It's really not being diverted. And Bob Schuster's presentation here says it. Somebody else, who was it, had a poster downstairs about looking on the internet and just plotting the when you put in the
Michigan folks.
It may have been.
I was talking to her. About
put in the name of a drug and then you see what comes back, and Vicodin, you know, 90% of what comes back is here, buy it without a prescription. And buprenorphine, on the other hand, at the far end of the spectrum, is it's all about treatment. It's all about getting well and that sort of thing. So, I mean, buprenorphine is not a great drug to abuse. It's not a, you know, that's the beauty of it. It's not a fun drug to abuse. So it's the perfect drug for treatment. So, yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. Where it is.
So do you come to this meeting to follow it?
Well, I come to follow it, and I stay in the field. I'm trying to do some stuff at VCU now that I'm down there. We've started a new in the school in the department where I am in preventive medicine and community health. We we'd do an MPH program, and we've now instituted an MPH with an addictions track. And I'm trying to. I had a meeting last week, and brought in John Strang from King's College, and Jason White from University of Adelaide, to, and some of their people, and we met for about a week to try to develop a program that masters and ultimately doctoral students will get a degree from those three institutions, sort of a joint degree in addictions. So, you know, it's sort of exciting kinds of things to do that haven't been done before, because there's a real problem in translating a lot of the knowledge, certainly policy stuff, because treatment policy in the three English-speaking countries, those three English-speaking countries, are all different. Mm-hmm. And if you graduate the students, if you expose them to those differences early, then they can, you know, hopefully they'll be the leaders that ultimately pick the best from wherever it is and throw away the worst from wherever it is. Mm-hmm. And,
were you trained in public health?
No.
What were you?
No.
Did you?
Pharmacy and chemistry.
Pharmacy?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I wasn't sure. Where?
VCU.
So VCU.
For
you have a PharmD?
Medical College of Virginia. No, I have an MBA. I did an MBA at Loyola.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. I didn't get that early stuff. Well, that was really interesting. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
If I end up doing a book on buprenorphine, I'll come back and find you for some more.
All right.
That's
You're
great.
Welcome.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Give you a card.
I wish you luck with your wife.
Well, thank you.
That's
a bad disease. She was down here this week. So.
Oh, she was?
Yes, she was.
Oh, all right.
She was. She was.